All right, let's dive into something pretty fundamental today. We're going deep on a chapter from, well, I'd say the world's best free and peer-reviewed textbook out there, Orthopedia. That's Orthopaedia.com.
Edited by Bernstein, Penny, and Vayette.
Right, those three. Amazing resource. But before you go taking any tests, or even more importantly, before you go treating anyone, don't just rely on us. Go read the book.
Couldn't agree more. And for this deep dive, we're tackling rotator cuff tears. So when you hear rotator cuff, you're probably thinking arm rotation, right?
Descents, right. That's what comes to mind.
But let's challenge that assumption right off the bat. Is rotation really the primary function? What is it really all about?
That's the big question. We think rotation, but is that really the core of what the rotator cuff does?
Not really. See, the rotator cuff is actually four muscles that originate on your scapula, your shoulder blade, and then their tendons extend to attach to the humerus, your upper arm bone. We're talking about the supraspinatus, infraspinatus, teres minor, and subscapularis.
Okay, so four muscles bridging the scapula to the humerus. And the cuff part of the name comes from how those tendons attach, right? Kind of like the cuff of a sleeve.
Precisely. Their insertions on the humerus are kind of confluent, meaning they blend together. Imagine several ropes tied together at a single point. That's how these tendons create a unified cuff around the humeral head. You can see this really clearly in Figure 1 in Orthopedia, which gives you a posterior view. And Figure 2 likely provides another helpful anatomical perspective. The supraspinatus, infraspinatus, and teres minor all insert on the greater tuberosity of the humerus.
Okay, three of them on the greater tuberosity, got it. What about the fourth one, the subscapularis? Where does that one fit in?
The subscapularis is a bit different. It comes from the front, the anterior side of your scapula, and inserts on the lesser tuberosity of the humerus. And here's a fascinating anatomical detail. It's actually separated from the other three tendons by a space called the rotator interval. What's really cool is that the long head of your biceps tendon actually travels right through this rotator interval. So the subscapularis is a bit of an outlier, anatomically speaking.
Oh, wow. That is cool about the biceps tendon. So going back to that initial question, if rotation isn't the main function, what is? What's the rotator cuff's most important role?
Well, despite its name, the rotator cuff is all about dynamic stability. It's actively working to keep the humeral head, the top of your arm bone, snug within the glenoid fossa, that's the shallow socket on your scapula. Think of it like a golf ball on a tee, that's your glenohumeral joint. And beyond stability, the rotator cuff also helps initiate movements like abduction, lifting your arm away from your side, and elevation.
Yeah, the glenoid is notoriously shallow, right? It's amazing how much movement we have there without everything just popping out of place.
Exactly. It's not like your hip joint, which is much deeper and more stable. Without the rotator cuff constantly holding things together, the deltoid muscle, which is responsible for lifting your arm, would just pull the humeral head straight up when it contracts. We call this rostral migration, basically. The humeral head rides upwards out of the socket because the deltoid has nothing to oppose it.
So the rotator cuff is like a set of dynamic seatbelts for the shoulder, keeping everything where it should be.
That's a great analogy. By compressing the humeral head into the glenoid, the rotator cuff creates a stable pivot point, a fulcrum. And that's what allows the deltoid to work effectively, translating its power into controlled movement. Without that rotator cuff stability, the deltoid would just be pulling on a loose joint.
Makes perfect sense. Stability is the foundation for smooth movement. So let's say this crucial stabilizing system gets disrupted, like with a tear. What might someone actually feel? What are some common signs of a rotator cuff issue?
Well, people with rotator cuff problems often complain of pain in the front, or anterior, or the outer or lateral part of their shoulder. This pain often centers around the greater tuberosity, that bony bump you can feel on the side of your shoulder. And it's typically worse when they do things overhead, like reaching up into a cabinet or throwing a ball.
And is it usually a sudden, sharp pain that signals trouble, or can it be more gradual?
It can actually go both ways. Sometimes there's a prodrome, a period of milder, nagging symptoms that slowly worsen over time. Or the pain might ramp up quickly after a specific event, like a twist or a minor injury that didn't seem like a big deal at the time.
So if someone sees their healthcare provider with these kinds of symptoms, what might the exam look like? What would a clinician be checking for if they suspect a rotator cuff issue?
During the exam, you might be asked to move your arm in specific ways that activate the different rotator cuff muscles. And the clinician will be looking for weakness or pain. For example, weakness or pain when lifting your arm out to the side, abduction, might point to a problem with the supraspinatus. But and this is important, the shoulder has a lot of what we call muscle redundancy, meaning multiple muscles contribute to each movement. Because of that, some people can have what we call a compensated rotator cuff tear.
So they might have one or more tendons torn, but they can still function pretty well.
Exactly. They might not even realize how much damage there is because other muscles are picking up the slack. That's why a thorough physical exam with specific tests to isolate the different muscles is so crucial. Speaking of which, what are some of the key movements a clinician would want to assess during a shoulder exam?
Well, first, you'd want to check the active range of motion. How far can the person move their arm on their own? Then you'd assess passive range of motion. How far can the examiner move the arm when the person is relaxed? And then I imagine strength testing against resistance is really important.
Absolutely. You'd want to assess strength in key movements like elevation, abduction, and both internal and external rotation. But to really target each of those four rotator cuff muscles, we have specific tests. For the supraspinatus, there's a test where you lift your arm out to the side, but in the scapular plane, which is about 30 degrees forward from a straight side raise, while the examiner pushes against your arm. Orthopedia has a clear illustration of this in figure 4.
Okay, so that specific angle during resisted abduction really isolates the supraspinatus. What about the infraspinatus and tier A's minor? How do you test those?
We often test those together. The person would be asked to externally rotate their arms against resistance, but with their arms close to their sides and elbows bent at a 90-degree angle. Keeping the arms tucked in helps minimize the deltoid's involvement. You can see this in figure 5.
That makes sense. You want to really isolate those muscles. How about the subscapularis? How do you check that one?
A common test for the subscapularis is the liftoff test. Figure 6 in the book shows you what it looks like. Basically, you put the back of your hand against your lower back, around the mid-lumbar spine, and try to lift your hand away from your back. If you can't do that, it suggests there might be a problem with the subscapularis.
Those specific tests sound really helpful for pinpointing the source of the problem. Now let's talk about imaging. Can a regular x-ray show a rotator cuff tear?
X-rays are useful, but they don't actually show us the soft tissues of the rotator cuff directly. However, with a large, long-standing tear, you might see that the humeral head has migrated upward in the joint socket. But the main value of x-rays in this situation is to rule out other things that could be going on, like arthrosis, which is arthritis in the joint, calcific deposits in the tendons, or bone spurs.
So x-rays are more about the bigger picture and the bones. What about MRI? Isn't that the gold standard for soft tissue injuries?
You're right. An MRI magnetic resonance imaging is very good at detecting rotator cuff tears. Figure 7 in orthopedia shows a nice example. It gives us a detailed image of the soft tissues, and it can tell us the size of the tear, whether the tendon has retracted from its attachment point, and if there's any muscle atrophy.
So MRI gives us a much clearer view of the rotator cuff itself. But are there any downsides to using MRI? Can it be a little too sensitive and show things that aren't really a problem?
That's a great point. MRI is very sensitive, and it can pick up on things that might not be causing any symptoms. It's actually pretty rare to find a completely normal MRI in someone over 40. One thing you'll often see on MRI is something called a partial thickness tear. This means that the tendon is still attached, but there's some internal damage within the tendon fibers.
And that term tear can be a little misleading, can it? It sounds much worse than it might actually be.
Exactly. We use tear more in the sense of wear and tear in this case, not like a complete rupture. Sometimes this wording can lead people to think they definitely need surgery, which isn't always true.
It's important to make that distinction. So MRI is a great tool, but you have to interpret the findings carefully, considering the person's symptoms and what you find during the physical exam.
Absolutely. It's about putting all the pieces of the puzzle together.
We have been talking about a chapter from the free and peer-reviewed textbook, Orthopedia, at www.orthopedia.com, edited by Bernstein, Pinney, and Vayet. But before you take a test, and certainly before you take care of a patient, don't rely on us. Read the book.
So you might have shoulder pain and weakness and think it's a rotator cuff tear, but it could be something else altogether. That's what we call the differential diagnosis.
Oh, so it's like a detective game. You have to consider all the possible suspects.
Exactly. While problems with the rotator cuff muscles often mean a tear, there are other possibilities. For instance, if the suprascapular nerve gets pinched or compressed, it can weaken the supraspinatus and infraspinatus, mimicking a rotator cuff tear.
Wow, nerve problems in the shoulder, that's something you wouldn't want to miss. What are some other conditions that could be in the mix?
The list is pretty long. Subacromial bursitis, which is inflammation of the bursa in the shoulder, biceps tendonitis, labral tears in the shoulder joint, adhesive capsulitis, which is also known as frozen shoulder, arthritis in the shoulder or the AC joint, nerve problems coming from the neck called cervical radiculopathy, and even shoulder instability.
That's quite a lineup. How do you tell them apart? Like, how do you know if it's a rotator cuff tear versus, say, adhesive capsulitis or frozen shoulder?
Adhesive capsulitis or frozen shoulder can definitely look like a rotator cuff tear pain and limited range of motion. But here's the key difference. With frozen shoulder, the passive range of motion is also limited. So if the clinician tries to move your arm for you, they'll meet resistance. With a rotator cuff tear, you might have pain and weakness when you try to move it yourself, but the examiner can usually move it fairly easily.
Ah, so that limited passive motion is a big clue for frozen shoulder. Okay, so out of all these possibilities, who actually needs surgery for a rotator cuff tear? I'm sure that's a question on a lot of people's minds.
Absolutely. We generally think about patients in two main categories. First, those who had a sudden traumatic event, like a fall, and completely lost the ability to lift their arm. And second, those with more chronic pain, which may or may not have started with a specific injury.
I imagine the treatment approach would be different for those two groups.
You bet. For someone who is previously active, then suddenly loses function after an injury, surgery is often the best option. But this depends on imaging and MRI, usually to confirm that the tear is repairable and that the anatomy is suitable. It's also important to do the repair relatively quickly, ideally within a month, to prevent the tendon from retracting and making the surgery more difficult.
So early surgery is key for those acute traumatic tears. What about those with more gradual pain but still have some function?
For those folks, we usually start with non-operative management. That often includes physical therapy to strengthen the surrounding muscles and improve shoulder mechanics. Sometimes we'll also use corticosteroid injections into the subacromial space to help with pain.
So a more conservative approach for chronic pain with some remaining function makes sense. Now, if surgery is needed, what exactly happens during a rotator cuff repair?
Well, rotator cuff repairs can be done either arthroscopically, which means using small incisions and a camera. You can see an example in figure 9, or with a traditional open procedure. But no matter the technique, the basic steps are the same. Identify the torn tendon, clean up any damaged tissue, and then reattach the tendon to the humerus with sutures and anchors. If possible, we'll also try to suture the torn tendon to the neighboring intact tendons to add strength and support.
And what kind of outcomes can people expect after rotator cuff repair surgery?
It's interesting because most people do see significant improvements in pain and function after surgery. But how well they do doesn't always match up perfectly with whether the tendon actually heals back to the bone completely. Some people do great even if the tendon doesn't fully heal, while others might still have symptoms even though the repair looks intact on imaging. It shows you how complex shoulder function really is. And again, orthopedia goes into great detail about all of this.
That's fascinating that the clinical outcome isn't always a direct reflection of the anatomical healing. It really highlights the importance of rehab and all the other factors that contribute to shoulder function.
Exactly. It's not just about fixing the tear. It's about restoring the whole system.
All right. Let's wrap up by reviewing some of the key takeaways from our deep dive today.
Sounds good. Let's go over 5 terms that really capture the essence of what we've discussed.
First up, supraspinatus.
The supraspinatus is the topmost rotator cuff muscle, and it's also the one that's most commonly affected by tears.
Second, the rotator interval.
This is that space between the subscapularis and the supraspinatus, where the long head of the biceps tendon passes through. It highlights the unique position of the subscapularis.
Third, dynamic stability.
This is the rotator cuff's primary job, actively stabilizing the shoulder joint, not just rotating the arm.
Fourth, suprascapular nerve.
This nerve can get compressed, causing symptoms that mimic a rotator cuff tear, so it's something we have to rule out.
And finally, adhesive capsulitis.
This is frozen shoulder, which can present similarly to a rotator cuff tear, but the key difference is the limited passive range of motion.
5 great points to remember.
Absolutely.
We have just discussed a chapter from the world's best free and peer-reviewed textbook of musculoskeletal medicine, Orthopedia. Orthopedia by Bernstein, Pinney, and Vayet. It is available at www.orthopedia.com at no charge. And again, before you take a test, and certainly before you take care of a patient, don't rely on us. Read the book. You'll be glad you did.
And with that, we've come to the end of our deep dive.
But before we go, one last thing to think about. Given all the complexity of the shoulder, with its muscles, tendons, nerves, and the joint itself, and the nuances in diagnosing and treating shoulder pain, what do you think are the most crucial things a clinician needs to consider when evaluating a patient with shoulder pain?
Food for thought, for sure. Until next time.